I'm a few minutes late because I stopped a few times to look up at the sky. It's a magical night. The vastness of space. The moon is full or almost full. It's so obvious. The truth is so obvious. If you look around or you go out, there's the vastness of space, infinite space. And then there are a few things in space. So what we talked about, the two dimensions. It's so obvious, as within, so without, as without, so within, as above, so below. When you look around you, what you see is things in space. What you usually don't see, or you can't really see it, is space. But these two dimensions make up the world. This is very simple. Probably a four-year-old could understand that. You say, is this? And is this? And all that. And I said somewhere in the book, and I say it again, this is a statement of a somewhat mystical nature that cannot be verified through intellectual or scientific analysis, nor does it have to be. When you look into space, it's really your own depth. Infinity that you seem to see out there. It's your own inner space externalized. It's the world. Don't try to understand that. I don't. but it's all clear. And even that can be an opening to go out at night, a clear night, and simply to look at space. You can't see space, you only see the things that are in space. But there's this incredible mystery of space itself. And when you bring awareness to space, not trying to understand it or think about it, inner space is there. That was my first meditation. I didn't realize it was a meditation when I was in my teens, 13, 14, 15. We had just moved to Spain, where the sky is often clear. And so I would lie on the terrace and look without thought into space. Occasionally thoughts then came in and out again. The thoughts that a 13, 14-year-old has would come sometimes. If aliens come now, well, should I go with them or not? Well, a long time that was a dilemma. So after our session, I recommend that you acknowledge that dimension out there and at the same time within you. Of course, we're acknowledging it here too, within. In the right-hand side, outside pocket of my coat, there are a few written questions. I may have lost one or two on the way. Start with a short one. If nothing matters, why should everything be honored? Two small corrections in the question. It's not so much that nothing matters, but that nothing matters that much. It may matter in relative terms, but it does not matter absolutely in absolute terms. And another little correction. Why should everything be honored? There's no should. And what does that mean to be honored? To be acknowledged, to be given attention. What you honor is a term that I would not normally use, and I will modify it somewhat. It comes from Christian teachings. That is, what you honor or what you love is not the creature or the created, but you love and honor the creator in the created. I wouldn't call it creator, because that brings out the idea of some external agent that creates things. But there is a truth hidden there to honor the life essence, the one consciousness within each form. Although the form is short-lived, as all forms are. So to honor it is to honor that, but really what that means is there's a recognition there. You can't really honor it unless there's a recognition. The recognition comes when you approach something or someone or any life form without the conceptual barriers created by the thinking mind. When you approach it without that, there comes a recognition that it's not on a conceptual level, a sensing, a knowing of the other as not different from you. A sensing, a knowing of the other as ultimately yourself. And when that is recognized, then you honor everything in the manifested realm. Because you recognize yourself. And that honoring is also love. So when we say to honor, it's really to love it, to recognize it as in essence one with yourself. But should doesn't work. If I say you should honor, why should I? But it comes naturally in that recognition, the honoring of life, even of life, the forms of life, although yes, they are short-lived, but they are honored also. The life within the form, the great mystery the unmanifested within the manifested. And then on the level of form, whatever shapes and forms come and go, when that which is beyond form is recognized, then whatever happens on the level of form that is recognized as only of relative importance, not absolute. And then one could say it matters, but it doesn't matter that much. What really matters is for you to know that essence around you in the other, so that ultimately there are no others. And so the essence of egoic consciousness, the root of suffering, and also the root of evil, what we call evil, is complete identification with form. So that any other form is reduced to a mind object. Its life is not recognized because you are so identified with this form, both physical and psychological, of the form of me, or even worse, the form of us, a group, a tribe, that only recognizes, that completely identifies with this, our belief, our form, our history, us. And the more complete the identification with form is, the more suffering arises. The more suffering you create for yourself and others. The more suffering you create in the world. And so if sometimes people ask about the nature of evil, and it is only that, completely trapped in your own form. And then the opposite is true, that the recognition comes that you are in all forms. No longer trapped in that little bubble. Physical form, of course, you're somehow trapped in there for a while. But then the bubble of the psychological form of me. And then from there you look out onto a threatening world. From a short question, we go to a longer question. But sometimes the answers may not be, there may be a long answer to a short question and a short answer to a long question, or no answer at all. I don't know. It is so wonderful to see you again after such a long time. My spiritual trip, journey, has taken some interesting and confusing turns since 1.5 years ago. So I have a complex question. It is probably not a good question for live on tape, but I will let you decide. We are doing it. Don't need to switch off. So my question is, it seems that what motivates most of us in our study of your teachings is to achieve enlightenment, to reach the state that you are continuously describing. You are also advising us to do the techniques, look for the space, surrender to the moment, and so on. And yet you and many other enlightened people didn't wake up doing these techniques. No doubt these techniques help end suffering, or at least lessen suffering. But you woke up due to your suffering. You have even said yourself that these techniques will not lead to enlightenment. So why do we do them? Just to lessen suffering? They are very good at that. But it seems like they don't lead to enlightenment. So you can see the paradox that I am struggling with. So first, the relationship between suffering and freedom, realization, enlightenment, whatever, awakening. And so I want to honor, we've been in the last question talking about honoring. I want to honor the suffering that you and I have gone through that has brought us here, without which we wouldn't be sitting here. I wouldn't. Probably most of you wouldn't. Now, one could say, when you look at how suffering arises, that a lot of that suffering is self-created through egoic conditioned patterns. You create your own misery to a large extent in life, but that's the conditioning. Nothing personal in that, and it's not your fault. And life becomes heavy and serious. And then it becomes so heavy and serious that you can't stand it anymore. And that could already be the beginning of a movement in which, one could put it this way, consciousness is beginning to be forced out of identification with form through suffering. Because the suffering was the complete identification with form. We saw that just now. Suffering was the complete identification with thought forms, with emotional forms, with reactive forms, with the body form, the me form, the egoic form. Dreadful state. And then suffering becomes such a heavy burden that it reaches a certain boiling point of intensity, when your consciousness begins to be, and this is really the best way I can find of putting it, your consciousness is beginning to be forced out of identification with form. You're being forced out, and that's, but the suffering in the first place was created by egoic consciousness. So what's happening now? And that's the beautiful, yes, it is a paradox, I think, question, paradox is mentioned here, or dilemma, to understand that. First of all, egoic conditioning, collective conditioning, creates suffering, and it in many ways it loves its suffering. It loves its identification with form. It loves the heaviness that comes with that, the problems that come with that, the conflict that comes with that, the fighting and the reacting, and then it strengthens its form in those movements, so it wants that to continue. But that has already built in its own self-destruct mechanism through the grace of the divine. The ego, built into the ego, is a self-destruct mechanism, so to speak. And so a point comes when it creates so much suffering that it something awakens as if the nightmare of identification becomes unbearable, and then you suddenly begin to wake up, and you're still half in the nightmare and then half awake. And it could be you begin to wake up because for the first time you hear a phrase from a spiritual teaching. You might hear, that could be it, or nothing at all. It may not be that. It may just be the suffering itself. And so there's the beginning of a movement of consciousness removing itself out of the dream of form. And then it drifts back into form. And then, but once it started, that begins to have a certain momentum. It is the initiation. So many people are initiated into that through suffering. And it is rare for people to have such intense suffering that consciousness is forced out, totally out of identification with form once and for all. It can happen. But for most, it's a more gradual process. And that's awakening through suffering. And then comes a realization. Once that movement has started, there comes an insight into the mechanism of suffering. You cannot have that insight from within the conditioned thought patterns that make up your suffering. The insight into the mechanism, the mechanical nature of how suffering is created for yourself, how you create it for yourself, how the mind creates it, the pain body, the part the pain body takes in it, that realization comes only because there's some consciousness that is no longer trapped in identification with those suffering forms. And through that little bit of consciousness that has freed itself, from there you see the mechanism of suffering. How you do it to yourself is one way of putting it. How your mind does it to you is another way of putting it. And so then you see that that is a critical threshold where for the first time the possibility of living without suffering comes into your life. And the beginning of perhaps the realization that suffering may no longer be necessary for you. But you would never have reached that realization if you hadn't suffered up to that point. So this can be beautifully expressed in the paradox, which I may have mentioned once or twice before. Suffering is necessary until you realize that it is unnecessary. And so people have awakened. Some people have awakened through suffering, but suffering is everybody's spiritual teacher. There's nobody on the planet who does not have a spiritual teacher. And for 95% of the population, it's suffering. That's their teacher. And that works. But then there's a growing minority in the population where another factor comes in. But even for that factor, for you to be receptive to that, which is the factor of the power of spiritual teaching, to be receptive to that, usually, you must also have suffered enough even to be receptive to that. And often the receptivity and the openness to a spiritual teaching coincides with the first movements within yourself of your consciousness being forced out of identification with form. And then that little bit of consciousness recognizes the truth in a spiritual teaching. And then the process can accelerate. When you've had the suffering plus the spiritual teaching, that's a beautiful coming together, and it's often the case. And you can, and then what you then experience is that many people here have experienced and are experiencing, is a considerable lessening of the heaviness in your life, a considerable lessening of the suffering in your life, like a burden falling off your shoulders. Not that there's, in most cases, it's not a complete end, and it can well happen that periodically you get completely drawn back into identification with some egoic movement that produces suffering again. A wave comes and drags you along again. But then you come out again. Once that movement has started, you will come out again. And then it's, ah. So you move in and out of the dream or the nightmare, and then come out. And then the times when you're out may become a little longer. The clarity. So, of course, you've been coming to these talks and have been in contact with the teaching for maybe 4 years. And you yourself, if there had been no inner change, I'm sure you wouldn't have come back after a year. If it's pointless, why come back? So you yourself know that something is happening and has happened, even though at times the mind may not want to even recognize that, especially the egoic mind. Nothing is happening, but you know it's happening. You wouldn't have come back. Something is shining through the conditioned forms and at times becomes obscured again. And that is the awakening. Now, techniques, it is very true that nobody awakens through the application of a technique. They may have their place, they may be helpful for a little while on your path, but ultimately, a technique creates some distance where there is no distance between your being and where you want to get to. Because through some techniques you want to get somewhere. And so you've created a distance where there is no distance. You've created perhaps even future, because you need to get good at practicing the technique. So you've created a future in order to find yourself. You create a distance in order to be yourself fully, to be who you are. And so if you practice the technique, eventually you would have to drop it. Now, I don't think there are techniques here. What we do is so simple, it is simply a redirecting of attention into the body. If that's a technique, I'm sure that the cat lives like that most of the time, sensing the aliveness within, and any animal, and the tree senses its own life. That's why animals and plants don't have that fear of death. They can, and when the great danger comes, they withdraw deeper within. Did you know that a cat purrs not only when the cat is happy? I was told by a vet that sometimes cats purr when they are afraid. And I thought, how strange. And then realized, of course, they withdraw deeper to a deeper place within. When their form is threatened, they go deeper within. This is what an animal does. It withdraws from the external world. And so it unites with life itself, with the essence, the formless life essence within, and that is blissful. And so it purrs even when there's danger sometimes. And that the cat is not practicing a spiritual technique. It's a natural way of being. I'm simply redirecting attention to something that is very natural, and that is sensing the life within. And you're not creating any distance, and you're not creating any time. You sense it now. Now, it is possible that even a simple thing like that can be misinterpreted by the mind and used in such a way that it becomes a technique to you. And then the mind says, I must get better at feeling the inner body, or I'm not quite there yet. I'm not feeling it fully enough. I need to practice more. Whatever you can feel now is fine. You're feeling it. It's there. The mind will create time. It will create some distance and will make it into a technique. Now, another one that could be, some people call a technique, is to accept what is. That's how everything in nature lives. It aligned with what is. That's not a technique. Now, the mind might say, it's when the mind comes in, the mind can make it into a technique, because with mind comes ego. With ego comes needing to become something. And so it might say, I'm not yet good enough at accepting what is. I need to practice more. I need to become better at accepting what is. So immediately it creates future. And then it makes what is a very simple thing, the most natural way to live, makes it into a technique, and then you have time and distance, and you already have the beginnings of a problem. There's the beginning of a problem there, because then the very technique can become a problem to you. What is the opposite of all problems, to surrender to what is, can be transformed by the mind also into a problem. There's nothing that the mind cannot make into a problem and won't make into a problem. And there's nothing personal in this. It's not your mind. It's the mind. Every mind does that. And so instead of looking for enlightenment or complete enlightenment or liberation, somehow it seems it is more helpful to speak in, we'll use the terms that the Buddha used, who did not give you a promising little apple or carrot dangling in front of you saying, enlightenment, this is your ultimate goal. He had used more modest terms, in a way more helpful, and he just called it the end of suffering. That's enough. Another term he used is even less inspiring, and it's called emptiness or nirvana or nothing. But the end of suffering, the Buddha characterized his teaching as, I teach you suffering, which really means the origin of suffering. I teach suffering at the end of suffering. And the end of suffering is enlightenment. Now, the mind may have strange concepts about what it is. The end of suffering is the end of identification with form. And that's it. And if there's already a lessening of suffering, then you must be on the right path. The burden is less. Now the question often arises, True, nobody, we've already seen the technique doesn't get you there. So we're not really practicing techniques, although they could become techniques through the human mind. Some awaken through suffering only, some awaken through suffering plus a spiritual teaching. And the acceleration has already come into your life. It is a slow process that disidentification for most people who only have suffering as their teacher, unless they suffer tremendously, it's a slow process, gradual. And they have to relive more and more the same dramas again and again and again. And there's the third marriage and the fourth marriage and the fifth marriage. Just one example. And then maybe other lifetimes, the same stuff again, not much better. And they still don't know who they are. I wrote a little line in the new book which says, reincarnation doesn't help you if in the next lifetime you still don't know who you are. And some found it through not a tech. There was this spiritual teacher, Nisargadatta, who wrote this wonderful book. Well, he spoke it, I Am That. And how did he awake? Well, he must have had his share of suffering that somehow must have gotten him, we don't know much about his suffering, but it must have gotten him ready. So when he met this spiritual teacher, the spiritual teacher said to him something like, I don't remember the exact words, you are consciousness, you are unconditioned consciousness, that's who you are. He didn't say much more. And then he saw him one or two more times. And then he continued selling his cigarettes at a stall in the street. One wouldn't say, doesn't even seem a karmically very auspicious occupation. And that little pointer went through his mind. That is still a thought form, of course, a pointer. I am consciousness. I am consciousness. And he must have been so ready that that was all what was needed. I don't know how many years passed, not many, a few years, when the realization to which those words pointed began to arise in him. And he realized the truth of it, what the words pointed to. And that's how miraculous sometimes a spiritual teaching can be. But even him, it didn't come in one instant. There was a period of time during which that kept working in him. The pointer was working. And then it came. Ramana Maharshi, another beautiful teacher, he was only 17 when he was lying on his bed imagining that he was dead. It happened by itself. A disidentification from form happened, as it just happened to him. Most have to suffer up to a point. Humanity has been through enormous suffering as a whole, which each human, each one of you carries his or her share of human suffering. And there comes a point now, and we are approaching it, we may already be there, where suffering becomes optional for humanity. Because humanity as a whole has suffered so much already. And there are now children coming into this world who, and often they are maybe born into a relatively conscious family, and that's a new phenomenon in itself. In my generation, there was no such thing as a conscious family. Well, almost non-existent. There may have been one or two examples. But I don't know, knew anybody who came was born into a conscious family. They were all deeply unconscious. Even the term conscious was meaningless to most people. Probably didn't start until the 60s, with a few exceptions. But the main thing is you, the realization, which many of you have, that for your further evolution, the awakening, so that consciousness is moves out of identification with form, you may not need more suffering. That's the grace of the spiritual teaching. That through the grace of a spiritual teaching, you see that that's not what you need. But should it come, then that's fine too. And you can see very soon, you probably won't be in it for that long when it comes. Because whenever it comes, it will mean you're back identified with form. You're back lost in time, lost in mind, lost in pain body, lost in some reaction. But it's always identified with form. And that's why you suffer. Not knowing yourself as the formless. And you're resisting something which strengthens that is the identification with form. It strengthens the form. It's a dream. It's so clear that it's a dream. When you see people move into that, and especially people who move in and out, you see it's just so clear one day. Beautiful, alive, vibrantly alive, peace, aliveness, joy. And the next morning, I observed that when I was living in a commune, the incredible changes in people, how they were all into spiritual, how they became free, at times they were free, and then you would never know who would come down the stairs in the morning. And when you observe that in another, it becomes so clear that they are moving into a delusional dream world of that which is identification with form. And then they have their theories about life, about themselves, about you, about other people, about the world. They've all their interpretations, which are all totally distorted through form identification. And then they're telling you their story. They're telling you who they are, who you are, what's wrong with them, what's wrong with you, what's wrong with the world. And then at some point they wake up again. If presence has reached a certain degree of intensity in them, it is sometimes possible to awaken them in the middle of the dream. Not easy. To awaken them, watch what's happening, what do you feel, watch, be alert, what is there, what do you feel? If you're lucky, it works. But that requires already a considerable degree of presence that has been pushed out of the way. I love what they use in Buddhist monasteries when people get drawn back into their mind, or even people when they talk a lot, they will say, well, in the outside world, they would say, why don't you shut up? They say, watch your mind. Watch your mind. That's now considered an insult in a Buddhist monastery, because you're implying that they're totally unconscious. That's the greatest insult. Watch your mind. You watch yours. You're telling me to watch my mind? Look at your mind, what you were going on about yesterday, all that stuff. Who is talking? The mind. But of course it is a powerful, very powerful, and could we call it a technique? To watch your mind, to be present as a witness to your mind. Is that a technique or is it a way of being? A beautiful, awakened way of being. Is it a technique? The mind will make that into a technique too, and then I'm trying to watch my mind. But it's not working. A very powerful thing to watch your mind. Interesting too. And then you see that it doesn't matter that much what goes on in there. It wants to matter, but it doesn't. Lottery. And we will also have more time for questions tomorrow, of course. I'm looking for something short now. Could you please talk about devotion? Is there a devotional state that arises naturally out of presence? Yes, that does devotion, which is strongly connected, very intimately connected with other things, other words we could use. They're really all one. Devotion, gratefulness, and honoring. So when we used honoring before, that is an aspect of devotion. Devotion really means to recognize the divinity within the form. Now, when through some misperception you recognize it only out there, perhaps in a teacher or a guru, you recognize the divinity in him or her through a misinterpretation of the mind, then you could be devoted to something external and believe there's the center of the universe, there's God, or there's the embodiment of God. So with devotion, sometimes there's the danger that devotion is directed exclusively to the external and you forget the source which is within you, you forget yourself, so it's the recognition of the divinity simultaneously within and without. And then, of course, that devotion arises naturally out of the state of presence. It may not be immediately obvious or apparent as devotion because people associate devotion with certain, perhaps even certain gestures or certain. When we greet each other like this, this is very beautiful. We are not imitating some Eastern thing, which some people might think. This is a very beautiful greeting that says, I greet God within you. The God within me greets God within you, the One, the recognition of the One. I honor that. And sometimes you may go like that, and this is what people associate with devotion, perhaps, or prostrating yourself. That's not necessary, but if you do it, if it comes naturally, that's beautiful too. Not perhaps as a something that you should be doing, but if it's a natural thing, it's very beautiful, prostrating yourself. When, if it should ever come to you, it's a beautiful gesture. Not to anything really out there, just as an act of complete surrender to the totality, to the One. And so there is the honoring that is devotion, the honoring of life in all forms. And even the deluded life in the form of humans, deluded into thinking they are this or that, egoic delusion. And that is sometimes humans are the most difficult life form to honor. Because there's so much in the way. Nature is so, the being is so much there. And with humans, there's the density of mind and pain. But that also is accepted and honored and becomes transformed through that. Even you accepting it in another is the beginning of the transformation. It's healing. It's healing to come into the presence of someone who totally accepts you as you are. You're already being healed. That person isn't doing anything at all. If he wanted to help you or change you, he would be doing something. That the deep healing comes with that, and of course becomes greatly accelerated when you do it to yourself. You are accepting yourself completely as you are, including the pain body. The quickest way beyond pain body, there's a question here, says, please explain again how exactly the pain body works and how we get beyond it. Well, I'll summarize. Old pain, humanity's pain, and pain from childhood, maybe pain from many childhoods, you carry inside an emotional field of contraction, heaviness, turbulence, residue of emotion. It's added to as you go through life, through experiences that are not fully faced, not fully lived through, things that are accumulated inside you, You don't want to face this, don't want to face that, you don't deal with an emotion, don't feel it fully, then it gets stored, it gets becomes part of the pain body. Not only that, the universe consists of fields of energy. And there are energy, everything is an energy field. The flower is an energy field that we happen to perceive in this way through our senses. It's a vibrating energy field. Every human being is a vibrating energy field. And there are other energy fields that we don't even see with our senses. So those things can also happen. This energy field comes into you because it feels drawn to, it recognizes something that at that moment is active in you, a vibration of pain perhaps. And there may be an energy field produced perhaps by other humans. There's so much stuff, heaviness on the planet, that joins with the pain body. It feels drawn, oh, I recognize something here, says this floating cloud of energy. And then an unhappy person becomes even more unhappy. And then pain is then translated into thought. A painful story of my life and what life has done to me and others have done to me. And that pain came into you, joining your pain body temporarily, because it says, oh, here I can feed. It's a very normal thing. It's the nature is full of things like that, where things feed on other things everywhere in nature. So the same happens in the unseen realm. And we personalize it. We think, this is me. This is my pain. This is me. This is my story, my pain, my unhappy life. When it's simply an energy movement. It came because it's resonated with something in you. I wrote that originally in the book, but it was considered a little spooky, so we took that out. But it's not really spooky. So, and there are other energy movements that sometimes will give added energy to your pain body. It could be a simple thing as a certain astrological configuration. And so that movement suddenly comes. But we personalize it. It could be an entire energy stream that somehow you've linked into of hundreds of thousands of people living in your state or in your city, who are producing a certain energy field, and because you're receptive, your pain body happens to be active, it is receptive to that, and then becomes magnified through that, and it's nothing personal in it whatsoever. But it wants to become personal. It loves you to live under the illusion that this is me, my pain, my unhappy life, my suffering, mine, me. So it wants your identification with it. This is another aspect of identification with form. And when that identification is broken, you can see it for what it is. You can feel it, you can sense it, you can be there and witness it. That's all that's needed. The seeing, the recognizing. Feel it. So it is not personal. It is human pain. And even pain is a label. It is some kind of energy, whatever it feels like. That's all it is. And you feel it. Bring attention to it. And that implies you cannot fully feel it unless you accept it. You accept that this is what is. all of this. So this is the transition from an unhappy person to being the witness of an energy movement inside you. It's a huge transition from an unhappy me to being the observing presence of some contraction or some turbulence that you sense. That's not such a huge problem, is it? A turbulence that you sense. It's weather, inner weather. A thunderstorm. Lightning. And that's all that's needed for it not to feed anymore on you, on your thoughts, or on drama that otherwise you're forced to act out continuously. So you're much more accident prone if your pain body is active and you're identified with it, because the pain body wants something bad to happen. Doesn't matter what, as long as it's bad. It wants turmoil and drama in your life. And it will, if you are identified with it, it will move into the mind, and the mind will interpret your life in such a way that it is the most dreadful drama you can imagine. So that's the pain body doesn't like to be looked at. When it's even here, it can happen that a certain restlessness can come into you the moment we address pain body. And that's nothing personal, it's the pain body, human pain body. So the world is full of them. When you go out into the world, a certain percentage of people will be there with an active pain body. The others dormant for the time being. Maybe tomorrow it'll be active. And they are identified with it. Some 10% of the time. I don't know what the average is. 30%, 25%, and us. In some people it's 80 to 90%, and in some it's 100%. Imagine a continuously active pain body. And some of these people have important jobs in the world. The pain body got them there. They pushed everybody out of the way. And they're getting things done. And in the meantime, they're making everyone unhappy. CEO of the corporation. And then suddenly he dies. The body couldn't tolerate it anymore. And where does the pain body go then? Question here that is often asked, and a very good question. How to explain to children or how to help children understand or become conscious of. How would you please speak about sharing this way of being with children and teenagers? The best way of sharing it with children and teenagers is living it yourself. That's the primary way of sharing it. Whether or not you say anything is secondary. So the being is primary. And only you can know whether there is a moment when words are appropriate. So you living it means that in your family, in your home, or if you work with children as a teacher or some other capacity, that when you interact with the child or the teenager, you are present. There is stillness when you look at them. When you listen to them, there is space, giving them space, one could say. Give them space to be. And then they will do something, say something. But the giving of space, being there as space for them. And then they come into that space that you are as you look at them, as they come in shouting, "Is dinner ready, Mum?" Now, in most households, when you observe, there is an incredible lack of space. When you observe how the various members of the family interact, their life is crammed full with things, thoughts, things to do, next thing to do, get this done, do this, why haven't you done this? Everybody is continuously in a hurry to get to the next thing. And when they're not in a hurry, they're watching TV or playing the video games, what many children grow up with these days. So they go from there to, and finally there's nothing to do anymore, and then they go to and then they go to bed and an uneasy sleep, and then they wake up with somebody shouting, "Come on, let's get it, it's late, come on, get ready for school, have you done your homework?" "What, you haven't done your homework? Whoa, who are?" And then they run, and the school is the same, one thing after another, this and this, the next thing, the timetable is crammed full with things to do. Not one moment must be unoccupied, it's dangerous, no space. And but so it's just to have space at home in the family, to bring space, not to be consumed by doings, comings and goings and things, to be consumed by mental interactions only, one mind thing after another. It doesn't mean that you can't get things done anymore, but just acknowledge their being and your own. Just looking and listening is enough. Giving attention. Not interpreting or saying, not the kind of attention that the mind says, "Okay, what have you done today? Have you done that? You still have to do that, don't you? Have you put this on? Have you washed that? Have you put away your things?" They think that's giving attention. Or "How do you feel? Is there something wrong with you? Do you have a pain? Where is it?" And again, they think they're doing good, but it's continuous, it's fear dominated, it's nervous tension dominated interaction. Just look, listen, that attention, spacious attention. And you don't have to tell them, calm down, become present now. Now don't go into the future. Now I want you to be present. Have you been present today? And not even as a formal thing that the mind again says, okay, now the whole family from now on, we are meeting in the dining room at 8 o'clock, and between 8 and 8:15 we are present together. That's a technique. Then presence becomes a technique. And the children won't like it. They say, this is dreadful, I'm moving out. But you will be surprised at the transformation that happens in children only through you living it. That's all that's required. And if additionally, at an appropriate moment, you mention a little bit to the child about pain body, that can be helpful. Wait for an appropriate time when there is space, you are interacting, talking, and perhaps start with pointing to yourself, something that may have just witnessed in yourself. You know what you just saw, what I did this morning? That was old stuff inside me. There's still a lot of that. And depending on the age of the child, of course you use the words that are right for their age. So it's very easy for children to understand. Even 5 and 6 year olds can understand about pain body, even though you may not use that term for them. But they can see it, because children have pain bodies, some stronger than others. And if you can show a child to be present as the witness, that's an incredible thing. And then you can save a lot of suffering for the child, because then the pain body is not growing into an even bigger pain body. It will begin actually to lose energy the moment the child is able to observe it. Usually after the event, when they've understood the basic principle of pain body, you can see that little green monster that was there again, wasn't it, just now? Yes, it was. What did it feel like? Well, it felt there was it didn't feel good at all. It felt there was a stabbing, almost a pain in my stomach. I felt sick. Well, yeah, that's a little green monster. And occasion, and then it goes to sleep, and then it wakes up again, doesn't it? And somebody produced a children's book, which somebody showed me a couple of years ago. It's all drawings with very little writing, just short book with big colorful drawings of a little boy coming home in a very bad mood. Don't want anything to eat. He goes up to his room, and then he feels worse and worse, and he turns into red and green. And then this huge monster comes out of his mouth and fills the entire room. And the monster starts throwing things around in the room, throwing around his toys. And he loves it, watching it, because he is it, he's doing it. But then the monster touches one or two of his favorite toys and throws them out. And suddenly the boy says, why are you doing that? That was my such and such. You're destroying it. And then that's the beginning of a recognition of that energy movement. And then the monster suddenly begins to shrink. And then jumps into a little box. So that is helpful, but living it is the teaching. especially words about presence, will hardly be necessary when you live it. Children are usually a little closer to the truth than adults anyway. So you don't even need to tell them, this moment is all there is. They know that already. And if they don't know it, at an early age they've been reconditioned to forget that. And that will be an important part of the transformation of consciousness, of course, is for children now to very quickly grow into conscious beings without having to go through what all the stuff we had to go through. Many of them won't have to do that anymore. Some still will. I'm talking still about a minority of the population, but it's growing. When you step outside, in the sky, if it's still clear, look up for a while into the vastness. Of yourself.